Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Tuesday, May 6th. Your readers are
Marjorie Huntington
and Allie Irving. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by the Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We will begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 p.m., our featured program will be Independent Living. Now it's time for our TV listings.
Okay, this evening on ABC, starting at 8 o'clock, is Will Trent. At 9 o'clock, The Rookie. At 10 o'clock, Bad Romance 2020. On CBS this evening at 8 o'clock, FBI. At 9 o'clock, FBI International. And at 10 o'clock, FBI Most Wanted. On the Fox Network, starting at 8 o'clock, The Cleaning Lady. At 9 o'clock, Alert Missing. And at 10 o'clock, WRAL's News. On NBC this evening, starting at 8, Night Court. At 8:30, another episode of Night Court. At 9 o'clock, The Voice. And at 10 o'clock, Yes, Chef. On ION this evening at 8 o'clock, Chicago Fire. At 9 o'clock, another episode of Chicago Fire. And again at 10 o'clock, another episode of Chicago Fire. On PBS this evening at 8 o'clock, Finding Your Roots. At 9 o'clock, Patty Yinch explores Pan-Americana. At 10 o'clock, Frontline. On the MNT Network at 8 o'clock, Dateline. At 9 o'clock, Suits. And at 10 o'clock, another episode of Suits. On the CW this evening at 8 o'clock, WWE. That goes until 10 p.m. And at 10, it's the National News Desk. And then again at 10:30, the National News Desk. On A&E this evening at 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock, and 9:30, episodes of Neighborhood Wars. At 10 o'clock, Parent Wars. And at 10:30, another episode of Parent Wars. On AMC this evening, there's a movie starting at 8 o'clock, Hacksaw Ridge. On the BET Network, there's a movie in progress at 8. It's House Party. That goes until 9 o'clock. And at 9, we have an episode of Pain. At 9:30, AS Living. At 10 o'clock, Pound 4. And at 10:30, Pound 4 again. On the Disney Network, at 8 o'clock, Big City Greens. 8:30, another episode of Big City Greens. At 9 o'clock, Stu Go. At 9:30, Kiff. At 10 o'clock, Zombies. And at 10:30, Ladybug. On Discovery this evening at 8 o'clock, Street Outlaws, Locals Only. At 9 o'clock, Red Bull Soapbox Race. At 10 o'clock, Caught. And at 10:30, another episode of Caught. On ESPN this evening, in progress at 8 o'clock is NHL Hockey. And then again at 9:30, NHL Hockey. On Nickelodeon at 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9, 9:30, 10, and 10:30, episodes of Friends. On the TNT Network, NBA Basketball. And then again at 10 o'clock, NBA Basketball. On the USA Network, starting at 8 o'clock, Law & Order Special Victims Unit. And at 9, another episode of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. And again, same thing, 10 o'clock, Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
And now for the front page. Jockeying for Pope begins before conclave. The Pope has died. Hundreds of cardinals are gathering in Rome. The secret ballot for a successor hasn't begun. But among church leaders, talk about who will next lead the nearly 2,000-year-old church is already underway, according to experts. Pope Francis, the first head of the Catholic Church from the Americas and a champion of people on the margins, died at age 88 on Easter Monday, April 21st, leaving vacant his seat at the head of the ancient institution with 1.4 billion followers worldwide. Around 250 cardinals were summoned to Italy for business, including the Pope's funeral. And chief among their duties, electing the 267th head of the church. Yet the drama of papal selection has already begun. The days before the conclave May 7th at the Vatican are not idle, and an unspoken selection process is already underway amid whispers in corridors and cafes throughout Rome and other cities in Italy. This is very much the crucial period, in fact, simply because in any election you need momentum. Robert Harris, the author of the novel behind the blockbuster film Conclave, told USA Today, "I don't know how you can do that without being pretty well known, and the best period to become well known is now." There's a lot happening right now in terms of papal politics and posturing. The week ahead of the conclave is just as important as the conclave itself, many experts say. Selection of the next pope will happen at the Sistine Chapel, where cardinals vote, bound by an oath of secrecy under the watchful eyes of Michelangelo's Last Judgment. The mystery of what happens behind the locked doors has inspired books, podcasts, and the conclave film, nominated for Best Picture at the most recent Academy Awards. At private meals and over aperitifs throughout Rome and at formal gatherings of cardinals, church leaders are finding who they trust to take over. The process is not all that unlike the wheeling and dealing made famous in the writings of 15th century diplomat and philosopher Niccolò Machiavelli, another noted centerpiece of Italian history. "A lot of very important groundwork is done at this point because the rules are more relaxed around talking," said Harris, who came to writing thriller novels from a career as a political journalist. "One mustn't think of this like an election where someone is going around saying, 'Vote for me.' That would be the kiss of death. But they have their supporters saying, 'I think you should come and see Cardinal X or Y.'" Papal posturing in Rome. Over 130 cardinals will vote in the conclave, which is limited to those under age 80. Francis appointed 108 of them. Most come from Europe, but they also represent 20 African nations as well as Asian nations, including Iraq, Iran, China, and Indonesia. Many might have never met before, and the days leading up to the conclave are when they become acquainted. The 117 non-voting cardinals will also make the most of the period. They may not be able to vote for the next pope, but they still hold a tremendous amount of sway, and pre-conclave days are their only chance to voice what they think the church needs. Much of the pre-conclave debate happens at formal gatherings of cardinals called general congregations. Church leaders rarely divulge specifics of the meetings, but the story of Francis's own election goes back to a speech he gave at an assembly during the pre-conclave period in 2013, after Pope Benedict the 14th, stepped down. 16th stepped down. Experts on going-ons at the Vatican say there are already signs of clear potential successors, seen in Cardinal Baltazar Enrique Porras Cardozo, hinting the vote won't take long, according to John L. Allen, Jr., editor of Crux, a Catholic news outlet. "I was struck that Porras, the cardinal from Venezuela, told reporters after he came out of the general congregation that he thinks this conclave is going to be over in 2 days," Allen, the veteran Vatican whisperer, told USA Today over the phone from Rome. "That would suggest a consensus is beginning to form. He didn't say around whom, but he at least gave the impression that there's a kind of agreement starting to take shape." Starting May 7th, cardinals will be sequestered at the Sistine Chapel and voting will begin. Private lunches, dinners, drinks. Cardinals raise the question of who will make a good pope more directly at private lunches, dinners, and over drinks throughout the Italian capital, according to Allen. Talk of who could be the next pope goes on well beyond the walls of Vatican City, according to Allen, an American correspondent based in Rome for the past 30 years. These are also opportunities to grind the political sausage, and in those situations, the conversation is also very direct. "What do you think of so-and-so?" said Allen. That's exactly what this period is for. Restaurants that cardinals prefer, Allen said, include L'Eau Vive, a simple but elegant French restaurant across the River Tiber from the Vatican. Cardinals like it for the atmosphere as much as the poulet. The restaurant is run by women who are consecrated members of the Les Travailleuses Missionnaires de Immaculée, a Catholic religious society. Diners eat in view of a portrait of the group's inspiration, Saint Therese of Lisieux. And at 10 p.m., the staff takes a break in service to sing the Salve Regina, a Gregorian chant praising Mary that dates back to at least the 1200s. Another destination for the small groups of cardinals is the Borgo neighborhood, a warren of medieval alleys filled with classic Italian eateries that lies in the shadow of Hadrian's mausoleum. The rise of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, is traced back to a block of cardinals that formed over plates of pasta and bottles of wine at Al Passetto di Borgo, just beyond the Vatican. Despite tempting Roman eateries, however, many cardinals prefer to dine out of the spotlight, Allen said. They gather at apartments of colleagues based in Rome or at the headquarters of religious orders. According to Allen, cardinals so far are signaling they want a pope who can take up Francis's mantle of leading by compassionate, positive example, but will also appease conservative elements in the church by clarifying doctrinal matters Francis left murky, including the church's stance on LGBTQ plus matters. They want someone who can inspire people and attract them to the faith, especially in the West, and above all in Europe, where the church is in trouble, to be frank. They want a pope who can light a fire, Allen said, but also someone who can hold his own on the world stage with the Donald Trumps, Vladimir Putins, and Xi Jinpings, because the world is going through an uncertain time where the old pillars of the world order seem to be falling apart. What it takes to be popable. Congregations of cardinals, where potentially all 252 cardinals assemble to discuss pressing church matters, are the most public part of the pre-conclave process. General congregations traditionally serve the function of preparing for the pope's funeral and the days of mourning for the deceased, according to Bri Jensen, a historian and host of a podcast specializing on papal history. But after the pope is buried, cardinals at the general congregations often turn their attention to the pressing question of who will become the next pope. They address the question indirectly through speeches on what the church needs and what makes a cardinal papable or fit to be pope, according to the host of the Pontifax podcast. The name of the show is a play on the traditional name of the pope, Pontifex. This is where we see the jockeying, said Jensen, and because we have a lot of very prominent cardinals over 80, this is where they get their chance. Cardinals have held at least 9 general congregations as of May 3rd. Official news from the Vatican about the assemblies lands like a dull sermon. A total of 183 cardinals attended the assembly on April 29th, according to the Vatican's official news outlet. Of those, 124 were voting cardinals and around 20 gave speeches. The Vatican summarized them as addressing themes related to the church and the challenges it faces, offering reflections shaped by the perspectives of their continents and regions of origin, as well as the church's possible responses. Jensen said Vaticanologists watch for what cardinals do outside the formal gatherings for a sense of what's going on in private, noting Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, a conservative from Germany, warned that the church could split if an Orthodox successor isn't chosen. It's a question of do we want to stick with Francis or break towards traditionalism, Jensen said. The fact that Mueller felt the need to come out and say that tells me the discussion is more Francis-oriented. Pope Francis's pre-conclave reveal. General congregations can also be a chance for a frontrunner to emerge like Francis did in 2013. At an assembly then, Francis gave a compelling 4-minute speech on the need for the church to take up its mission again of exercising compassion for people at the margins of society. Church leaders saw then that the man they could trust was Jorge Murillo Bergoglio, the then Archbishop of Buenos Aires in Argentina. That's where the cardinal electors said, this is probably going to be a good candidate, according to Father Aris Sison, a spokesperson of the Diocese of Cubao in the Philippines. We need a church that is going to focus outside itself. Francis's speech later became seen as a blueprint for his approach to leading the church. In it, he notably used the term peripheries, referring to expanding the church outreach to downtrodden people. The term became a hallmark of his papacy, eventually earning him the epithet the Pope of the Peripheries. Jockeying under a watchful eye. Amid widespread speculation over who will be the next pope, theologians say the faithful look at pre-conclave jockeying as a chance for the divine to intervene in human matters. A new pope doesn't fall like manna from heaven, according to Jennifer Newsom Martin, a theologian at the University of Notre Dame. There's a very real process of arguing for positions. It's a human process that respects the rationality and thinking of cardinals around what the church needs at this moment. The longtime Catholic University professor highlighted the church's longevity as an example of jockeying between guided by a higher power. From a theological point of view, and that of a practicing Catholic, the Catholic Church is obviously a flawed institution insofar as it's filled with human beings, she said. But also, the truth of the matter is that it's endured for so many years, so there's something in the apolitic process that makes it durable and not just the object of contingent forces. She added, these are holy men who are praying and invested in the outcome, and it's hard to untangle the human from divine acts.
Trump's idea for reopening Alcatraz was tried before. For those who've seen any of the dozens of movies featuring Alcatraz over the years, just hearing the word conjures images of the 22-acre island in San Francisco Bay and its notorious former prison, closed down more than 60 years ago. Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage teamed up on there for 1996 movie The Rock. It was also seen in 1979's Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood and was portrayed in the final battle scenes of X-Men: The Last Stand in 2006. So when President Donald Trump dropped the words rebuild and open Alcatraz in a Truth Social post just before 7 p.m. on May 4th, it quickly gathered interest. It's not the first time the idea has been floated to use the aging facilities to house detained immigrants. It's a symbol of law and order, Trump said in response to a question from Reuters reporter on the night of May 4th about what gave him the idea. It's an idea I had, Trump told reporters in remarks later in the evening. So many of these radicalized judges, they want to have trials for every single person that's in our country illegally. When we were a more serious nation in times past, we did not hesitate to lock up the most dangerous criminals and keep them far away from anyone that they could harm, Trump said in the Truth Social post. No longer will we tolerate these serial offenders who spread filth, bloodshed, and mayhem on our streets. That is why today I am directing the Bureau of Prisons, together with the Department of Justice, FBI, and Homeland Security, to reopen a substantially enlarged and rebuilt Alcatraz to house America's most ruthless and violent offenders. At the moment, Alcatraz is a very popular National Historic Destination, part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Alcatraz attracts $60 million in revenue for park partners and attracts 1.6 million visitors per year, according to the National Park Service. It was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976 and named a National Historic Landmark in 1986. When the maximum security prison was closed by then Attorney General Robert Kennedy in 1963, the Federal Bureau of Prisons stated it was too expensive to continue operating because it needed $3 million to $5 million in restoration and maintenance. The Bureau reported it was three times more expensive to operate than any other federal prison, primarily because of its physical isolation and lack of fresh water. In 1981, Alcatraz Island was one of 14 sites evaluated as the Reagan administration searched for a location to hold 10,000 to 20,000 Cuban detainees during the Mariel boatlift. However, the site was rejected because of its lack of utilities, historic nature, and popularity as a tourist destination. Even at its maximum capacity, Alcatraz could only have held 336 inmates, but its population never reached more than about 300, according to research in a 1994 paper published by the Oxford University Press. This isn't the first time this year that Alcatraz has come up among the Trump family. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., said on X in January, responding to a post about sending criminal undocumented immigrants to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, "Maybe we should open Alcatraz." One National Parks website refers to Alcatraz as the grimmest symbol in North America of the hand of justice. It once served as a place where the indigenous Ohlone and coastal Miwok tribes would isolate people who broke tribal law. In 1775, Spanish explorer Juan Manuel de Alea is said to have named it Isla de los Alcatraces, which translates to Island of the Pelicans. It was the site of the first lighthouse on the West Coast and became the first navigational lamp on the West Coast in 1854 and was the home of military forts during the California Gold Rush. It began holding prisoners during the Civil War and eventually opened as a maximum security prison in 1934. It gained notoriety because its prisoners included infamous criminals such as Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly. It was noted for holding incorrigibles for punishment and incarceration, including those who had been a management problem in other prisons, according to histories from the National Park Services and the Bureau of Prisons. Over 29 years, 36 men tried to escape from Alcatraz. The outcome of these men who escaped in 1962 remains a mystery, according to the FBI. Frank Morris and brothers John and Clarence Anglin hatched an escape plan over months, including creating dummy heads made of plaster and real hair to make it appear that they were in their beds. They used a homemade drill made from a vacuum cleaner to loosen air vents in their cells, then left the prison through a utility corridor and launched a raft into the bay. That's where the trail went cold, and during a 17-year investigation, the FBI was never able to determine if the men had survived or not.
Diddy jury selection could be drawn out, interest high as rapper's case gets underway. The day of reckoning has arrived for Sean Diddy Combs, whose trial on a range of sexual assault charges could result in the one-time billionaire spending the rest of his once-gilded life behind thick steel bars. As he entered the Manhattan courtroom on May 5th, Combs hugged his lawyers as they and the prosecution began the laborious task of selecting the 12 people who could free or doom the rap mogul. Combs, whose empire once extended to fashion, traded the jail garb he has donned since September for a navy blue sweater over a white collared shirt. Dark glasses shielded his eyes, while salt and pepper tufts flecked his goatee. Jurors were questioned one at a time by the judge, the prosecution, and defense, their stated mission to try and seat a jury of 12 in just 3 days. May 5th's slow pace could put that timeline in jeopardy, as finding jurors who remain unbiased in such a high-profile case could prove challenging. Judge Arun Subramanian even joked that the process could feel as long as the famously lengthy Lord of the Rings movie series. The rapper's connections with celebrities from Jay-Z to Jennifer Lopez bring increased interest to the case. A huge array of big stars flocked to Combs' fabled white parties, which ran from 1998 to 2009, and there is some debate as to whether abuse took place at this high-profile event, in addition to more intimate gatherings known as freak-offs. And while King Night parties, where accusers alleged they were drugged and sexually assaulted. One juror, identified only as number two, said that despite having a sister who was physically assaulted by her first husband decades ago, he could remain impartial in the case. He also said, despite being familiar with the actors Michael B. Jordan and Mike Myers, two celebrity names that apparently could be mentioned in the trial, he could remain objective. Some prospective jurors were dismissed after saying they had seen damning images of the defendant or had relatives who had suffered abuse. Combs, 55, is facing federal charges of racketeering, sex trafficking, and transportation to engage in prostitution. He has pleaded not guilty to all five counts and recently turned down a plea deal that could have found him serving less than the life sentence that is possible if he is convicted on the major charges. The case against Combs, who rose from concert promoter to rap impresario to fashion and spirits magnate, is one of the highest profile trials for sexual misconduct since R. Kelly and Harvey Weinstein, both of whom were found guilty of a range of sexual abuse charges. Like those two men, Combs' power and influence created an impenetrable cocoon of privilege that, prosecutors will argue, insulated him from repercussions while devastating the lives of men and women who stayed largely silent for fear of his reach. Combs' team, anchored by high-profile lawyer Brian Steele, will aim to convince jurors that whatever happened in the rapper's private orbits was between consenting individuals and did not constitute the machinations of a criminal enterprise.
Papal pick gathering has some differences, but conclave's traditions go back nearly 2,000 years. The conclave that begins May 7 to pick a successor to Pope Francis will feature many long-established rituals, as befits a church that has been around for nearly 2,000 years. Cardinal electors will be sequestered from the outside world until a new pope is chosen. Every person involved, including support staff, will be required to take an oath of secrecy. Smoke from the Sistine Chapel chimney, black for no, white for yes, will announce whether a decision has been made. Within all those traditions that go back centuries, some new developments have emerged. Though Francis didn't make any major changes to the conclave itself, his outreach to what he called the peripheries left an imprint that will be felt in the upcoming gathering to elect his replacement. Here is how this conclave is different. Pope Paul VI set a rule in 1975 limiting the number of cardinal electors to 120, a norm that wasn't strictly adhered to in the College of Cardinals meetings known as consistories. However, this is the first time a conclave has gone over the 120 mark. Of the 252 current cardinals, 135 are under 80 and eligible to vote, although Antonio Canizares of Spain and John Niu of Kenya have said that they won't attend for health reasons. That leaves 133 voters, and a record 108 of them were appointed by Francis, more than 80%. That doesn't mean a progressive that follows in his footsteps will get the nod. Many of the new cardinals hardly know each other and may not share his views, but it is likely that it'll eliminate a hardcore conservative. The two-thirds majority is required. For the first time in memory, Europeans make up less than 50% of the voting cardinals, coming in at 47%. The trend in that direction was set in motion decades ago, but the advances of other regions stand out more than ever. In an unprecedented distribution, representatives from Latin America, 18%, Asia and the Pacific, 16%, and Africa and the Middle East, 14%, all make up at least 14% of the voting cardinals at the conclave. That's the same percentage of those from Italy, the formerly dominant presence at all these events. The Asian and African contingents made the biggest leaps since the 2013 conclave that elected Francis, no coincidence considering his outreach to those continents. There's never been a pope from what's now known as Asia, nor an African pope since the end of the 5th century. The three African popes before that, Victor I, Miltiades, and Gelasius I, were believed to be black and born during the Roman Empire. All three became saints. Now, one of the seemingly top candidates for the papacy is Luis Antonio Tangle, 67, an ally of Francis and a native of the Philippines, home to the largest Catholic population in Asia, about 85 million, and the third biggest in the world. Hardly a list of contenders is published without including Tangle's name. Likewise, two African cardinals, Peter Turkson of Ghana and Fridolin Ambego of the Dominican Republic of Congo, both advocates for social justice, are often mentioned as possibilities. They hail from fertile ground for the Church, which saw an increase of more than 3% in African Catholics from 2022 to 2023, totaling more than 280 million. That's 20% of the estimated 1.4 billion Catholics worldwide. There was a time, 455 consecutive years to be exact, when betting the new pope would hail from Italy made for easy money. Now it's a much different and iffier proposition. The centuries-old tradition of Italian pontiffs ended when John Paul I unexpectedly died in 1978 and was succeeded by the Polish-born John Paul II. The next two popes, Benedict and Francis, were from Germany and Argentina, respectively, and suddenly Italy was on an extended losing streak. There are strong Italian contenders among the current cardinals, including Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Parolin and Bologna Archbishop Matteo Zuppi. But with Italian voting representation down to 14%, odds of the next pope coming in from Italy have diminished. Still, it will be a while until any other nation catches up. At least 216 popes are 200 more than the next century on the list, and that's France. Francis would be proud that the electors at this conclave hail from 71 countries, in keeping with his desire for the Church to become more inclusive. Italy still leads with 17, followed by the United States with 10, and Brazil with 7. Perhaps more notable is the presence of more than two dozen cardinal electors from countries that have never voted for a pope, among them Rwanda, Myanmar, and South Sudan, according to the Washington Post. It has become more exotic, said Massimo Fugili, a professor of theology and religion studies at Villanova University. There are now many cardinals from Asia and North Africa who are potential popes. That makes it different than it has been for many, many centuries.
You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned subchannel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assisted technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following the initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. From the Disability Rights North Carolina, DRNC, our work is threatened. Can we count on you so our community can continue to count on us? Did you know this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Protection and Advocacy PNA Network? As North Carolina's designated PNA, Disability Rights North Carolina has proudly carried out our federally mandated mission, protecting and advocating for the rights of people with disabilities across our state. Funding cuts threaten the services and protections we provide to individuals with disabilities and those who love and care for them. This isn't just a budget line. This is about real people losing access to education, health care, safe housing, and the support they need to live with dignity and independence. We are proud of what we've accomplished, but we cannot continue this work without your support. We urge you to act now to protect the rights and safety of disabled North Carolinians. Together, we've built something powerful over the last 50 years. Let's make sure it lasts for the next 50 and beyond. To find out how you can help, go to https://disabilityrightsnc.org/take-action/. Affordable and accessible housing. Know your rights. Join the Triangle Disability Awareness Council, or DAC, for a seminar about affordable and accessible housing and the rights of people with disabilities. This seminar is for tenants as well as landlords and housing providers and will be held in person and on Zoom, so virtually. Speaker Michael Mansett, lead attorney, Fair Housing Project Legal Aid of North Carolina, will cover affordable and accessible housing, home ownership and rental, landlord and tenant rights, and reasonable accommodation versus modification. There will be plenty of time for questions and answers. The event will be held on May 7th, 2025, from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. in person at 2501 Homestead Road, room 109, Chapel Hill, and on Zoom. The link will be provided at registration. You can register by going to www.triangledac.org/DAC event/affordable-and-accessible-housing/. For more information, call TDAC at 919-245-4337 or email info@triangledac.org or visit their website www.triangledac.org. Reasonable accommodation upon request. Have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of the Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on a AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell you the denotes denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at www.bep.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor, who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit www.bep.gov or call toll-free 844-815-9388. Local plays with audio description in Raleigh, Sunday, May 11th. Schoolhouse Rock Live, Jr., 3 o'clock. Raleigh Little Theater, 301 Pogue Street, Raleigh. 919-821-3111. You can get a free ticket for your driver. Be sure to ask. In Greensboro, Saturday, May 10th, Back to the Future at 2 p.m. Sunday, May 11th, Back to the Future at 1 p.m. Both shows are at the Tanger Center at 300 North Elm Street in Greensboro. The phone number is 336-333-6500. Tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. These tours are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. These docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are available by request only. You must arrange them at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please contact Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull, that's M-H-U-L-L, at ncartmuseum.org or call 919-664-6854.
Our first opinion piece this evening is titled, For a Child All Alone, a Great Teacher is the Only Hope, and it is provided by Larry Strauss. Mr. Strauss is a high school English teacher in South Los Angeles and has been since 1992, and he's the author of Students First and Other Lies, Straight Talk from a Veteran Teacher, as well as A Lasting Impact in the Classroom and Beyond, a book for new and struggling teachers. If you Google Teacher Appreciation Week, you'll discover an endless supply of gift ideas. But teacher frustration and teacher shortages suggest that a Starbucks gift card and a mug full of candy probably isn't enough to make teachers feel appreciated. I asked John B. King, a former U.S. Education Secretary, current Chancellor of the State University of New York, and author of Teacher by Teacher, The People Who Change Our Lives, what he thought might show teachers enough appreciation to help stem the exodus and attract enough young and talented people to teach the next generation. He said, without hesitation, that we need to pay more, especially to new teachers, and create better working conditions. He didn't just mean smaller class sizes and more administrative support. Those willing to dedicate ourselves to educating other people's children need the resources to do it, including access to field trips. John, 50, still vividly recalls a fourth-grade field trip to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and how Mr. Alan Osterweil opened up for the world to him and helped him through his trauma and grief. It is why so much of King's new memoir is dedicated to the teachers who made a difference for him. John lost his mother, a school counselor, when he was 8. His father, New York City's first black deputy school superintendent, was by then in his 70s and in physical and mental decline. Sometimes volatile, otherwise disengaged, John B. King Sr.'s deteriorating condition helped compel John Jr. to become his caretaker. By age 11, John was paying bills, buying food, and was pretty much on his own, and profoundly alone, except for the guidance and inspiration of the teachers who helped him to love learning and believe in himself. John managed to overcome a shattered young life of instability and achieved personal excellence and a long list of accomplishments as proof of his own strength. But John isn't interested in self-made man status. He knows, as well as anyone, that making a country great is always about raising the next generation, that nurturing children, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually, is a group effort, and that for some children, as he puts it, a teacher is the only hope. Another great teacher, Celestine Dissure, whom he affectionately calls Miss D, was there for him when he started junior high and in a new neighborhood. Her love of learning and encouragement helped John continue to feel at home in class when there was no other real home in his heart. She helped him continue to develop as a thinker with a passion for justice and confidence in his spoken and written voice. When his father died in 1987, John wound up with an older half-brother and a different kind of instability. Despite the shock of suddenly being, as he puts it, the only black guy in the class of Smithtown West High School on Long Island, school remained his oasis. He attended two more high schools before ascending to Harvard, a rather spectacular climax to an an agonizingly nomadic childhood, grounded only by school success and a love of learning, instilled in him by his mother and nurtured by a few great teachers. John's book inception came about after his family journeyed in 2019 to a plantation on which his ancestors had been enslaved in Maryland. It was the subject of a feature story in the Washington Post and is now, in John's own voice, the final chapter of Teacher by Teacher. 6 years later, that story offers a powerful critique of attempts to suppress history. When the Kings approached the Beckers, whose ancestors had enslaved the Kings, the Beckers were receptive to the reunion and made no attempt to revise the ugly past that awkwardly and painfully tied them together. It is a perfect ending to John's memoir, a bittersweet melding of history and emotional memory, an affirmation of identity and recognition at the bottomless agony, but also hope in the future for all of us. Perfect also because the journey became about from a fascination with history instilled in John by Mr. Osterweil, Miss D, and all the other influential teachers in his life. By 10th grade, students will be reading this chapter as part of a writing project this month, forever connecting my own teaching and the lives of my students here in Los Angeles to the legacy of John's teachers and to his family and his family's life. No reason teachers can't also celebrate Teacher Appreciation Week. John said that if you ever had a teacher who made a difference, find that person and tell them. He recalled his father's wake and how a man in his 50s came to pay his respect and spoke reverently about the lasting impact John B. King Sr. had had. I'm sure, John said, he wished that he'd told those things to my father.
Our second opinion piece, I Was a Hamas Hostage, My Fight Isn't Over. This is written by Ileana Gritzewski. Ileana Gritzewski was kidnapped from Kibbutz Nur Oz on October 7, 2023, and held by Hamas for 55 days. Her partner, Matan Zangakoker, is still in captivity. As Israel celebrated its Independence Day last week, the word freedom rang hollow for me. More than 550 days have passed since Hamas terrorists tore through our communities, and even though I was released after 55 days in captivity, I still don't feel free. How could I? Matan Zangakoker, my boyfriend, remains in Gaza, and my heart remains imprisoned with him. Matan and I chose a quiet life in Kibbutz Nur Oz. We loved our mornings together, coffee, a cigarette, and the peace of the countryside, far from the noise of the city. After immigrating to Israel from Mexico in my teens and launching a confectionery business, I eventually found my way to the kibbutz and began working at a medical cannabis farm. That's where I met Matan. Life was simple, peaceful, until October 7th, 2023. Trying to escape Hamas, we jumped out of safe room window. That morning, everything shattered. Terrorists stormed our kibbutz, going house to house, murdering, burning, until they reached ours. We jumped out of the safe room window as bullets tore through the door. We ran in different directions. I lost sight of Matan. Moments later, I was captured. They beat me and forced me into a motorcycle, wedged between two gunmen. They covered my head with tarpaulin and pressed my leg against the exhaust pipe, burning it. One of them groped me under my shirt. I passed out before we crossed into Gaza. I woke up on the floor, half naked, and with seven terrorists standing over me. I still don't know what happened while I was unconscious. I told them in English that I had my period. I don't think I've ever been so thankful for my period. I believe it saved me from worse. For 55 days, they moved me from place to place, private homes, a hospital, and eventually a tunnel. Despite telling them I had a chronic digestive illness, I received no medication. When I was released during the November 2023 ceasefire, I was so flooded with adrenaline I didn't sleep for 2 days. Coming back from captivity, you don't understand that it's really over. You don't know who you are. You barely remember your name. I returned with a broken hip and jaw, hearing loss in one ear, and was dangerously underweight. These health issues still haunt me. I live with chronic pain. I'm pre-diabetic, but I can't focus on healing. How can I when Matan is still there? In December 2024, Hamas released a video of Matan. It was the first time I've seen him since the attack. It wasn't the man I knew. He was thin, terrified, eyes pleading silently to be saved. It broke me, but it also gave me hope. He's alive. I live with the question, why me and not them? I have no answer. But I believe that if I made it out, it's because I have a role to play, to speak out, to fight for the living, and to help return those who were murdered for a proper burial. I recently returned from the United States, where I met with U.S. senior officials, spoke to Jewish communities, and addressed a rally in Central Park. With the release of 38 hostages during the first 100 days of the Trump administration, I felt something I hadn't in a long time. Hope. It reminded me that progress is still possible. Watching so many families reunite over the past couple of months pierces my heart with both joy and pain, joy for them, and desperate longing for my own reunion with Matan. I'm still not really able to take care of myself. I don't think my brain has fully grasped everything I've gone through. How could it when my story is still unfinished? Each morning I wake up knowing Matan is still there, waiting, hoping for someone to bring him home. The 100th day of Donald Trump's presidency on April 30th coincided with a deeply personal convergence of moments: Israel's Memorial Day, Israel's Independence Day, and also my birthday. This was my second birthday since being released without Matan. What does freedom mean when those we love remain imprisoned? As the entire nation of Israel paused to honor Memorial Day and celebrate Independence Day, the contrast between national reflection and personal grief is overwhelming. We mourn not only our fallen heroes, but also all the victims of that terrible, bloody massacre. We remember those who were slaughtered in their homes and at the Nova Music Festival, and we pray for those still held in darkness. Can we truly celebrate freedom when our people are still in captivity? Can we fully honor the fallen when some haven't even been buried? On a day when I should be celebrating both national freedom and my own life, so many families remain in limbo. What does freedom really mean when those we love remain imprisoned? I will not stop fighting until I can hold Matan in my arms again, until every hostage comes home. Until that happens, my freedom, and in many ways, Israel's independence, remains incomplete. Each day that passes is another day stolen from Matan, another day that I and 58 other families live suspended between hope and despair. They're still there, many of them alive, but they won't be for much longer without action. Don't forget those still denied their freedom. Don't forget Matan.
And now from the money section. Is that second rum and coke really worth it at 30,000 feet? Jody Smith lost count of the number of rum and cokes that her seatmate ordered on a recent flight from Boston to Los Angeles. Was it 5 or 6? He was a nervous flyer, Smith remembered, old enough to order alcohol, but too young to make good decisions. After the third drink, the passenger started slurring his words, so Smith made eye contact with the flight attendant who had been mixing the Cuba Libres. She gave her a look of, "Can you do something about this?" She just shrugged, Smith said. And the flight didn't end well. For the sake of our family audience, let's just say it involved a lot of noise, agony, and the discharge of bodily fluids. Smith, an etiquette expert, still has one question about the incident. In most states, bartenders are legally obligated not to overserve, she said. Why doesn't this also apply to those serving drinks in the air? She's not the only one asking. Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary recently blamed most of the air rage incidents in Europe on overconsumption and suggested a 2-drink limit at airport bars. Since then, there have been a string of embarrassing incidents involving alcohol on planes, including inebriated passengers, crew members, and even pilots. So as this summer rolls around, it's not so much a question of whether drink limits are a good idea. It's more an issue of what limits make sense. A new survey by Global Rescue found that some travelers support limits on alcohol. About 1 in 5 passengers say airlines shouldn't serve more than 1 drink every 30 minutes, while 17% favored a limit of 1 an hour. A majority say serving alcohol should be left to the discretion of the crew member or bartender. Dan Richards, Global Review's CEO, said there was one takeaway no matter how travelers voted. While travelers should always be responsible for their consumption, airports and airlines also have a duty to ensure the safety of all passengers, he told me. The problem is surprisingly complicated. Imposing a drink limit sounds like an easy solution. While we're at it, maybe there should even be a federal law that would limit alcohol consumption on domestic flights. But this issue is surprisingly complex. For starters, alcohol is by far the biggest source of onboard revenue, so cutting off passengers would make a dent in the airline's industry's profits. During the pandemic, some airlines stopped serving alcohol amid an epidemic of in-flight violence, but they quickly resumed beverage service to reclaim lost revenue. It's common knowledge that limiting alcohol can improve the quality of the flight. Recent research by the University of Texas found that consuming alcohol was a significant contributor to passenger misconduct. And German researchers also discovered that drinking on planes can harm your health. But the problem is, neither passengers nor airlines want limits. There's yet another layer of complexity. Many passengers board their flights already intoxicated because they've been hanging out at the airport bar. And those watering holes in the terminal selling overpriced cocktails would, of course, go out of business without nervous flyers who order a few drinks before their flights. So you can't just limit or ban drinking on a plane. You have to apply sensible rules to airports as well. And if you were cheering for a new drink limit rule, consider this. There already is a federal law that limits alcohol consumption on planes. It forbids airlines from serving anyone who appears to be intoxicated or who has a deadly or dangerous weapon accessible, among other things. So why did Smith's seatmate, get so many rum and cokes? Perhaps the flight attendant had to make her sales quota. Should you drink on a plane? The decision about whether to drink or not on a plane is a personal one. Here are a few things to consider. Don't forget, you are on a plane. I know, it sounds obvious, but most people don't think about the effects of being in a pressurized cabin. Unfortunately, sometimes the effects of alcohol don't show until the plane is in the air or the passenger has their next drink, said Beth Blair, a former flight attendant. She remembers serving a passenger a Bloody Mary, only one, and the next thing she knew, he was knocking on the door of the flight deck, demanding to speak to the captain. The FAA and FBI met our flight, she recalls, and there were severe consequences. If you drink, do it in moderation. That's the consensus of the behavioral experts that I talked to for this story. If we get a little bottle of wine or beer in economy class with our meal, that should be enough, said etiquette expert Adidota Zink. No more alcohol than that. This way, we would have our wine and there would be much less intoxication. You're really better off avoiding alcohol on flights altogether. That's especially true if you take any prescription medications. The vast majority of medical emergencies that our team has been asked to intervene in with other passengers have involved alcohol, said Bob Batchelor, managing director of Flying Angels, a medical transportation service. It's usually a combination of alcohol and sedatives. I can't stress how dangerous the combination of sedatives, alcohol, and decreased cabin pressure is. Ultimately, the choice is yours, of course. But ask yourself, do you want to end up getting hauled off the plane in handcuffs like the guy on Blair's flight? Maybe you can wait until you land to have that drink. So how did we fix the problem? I've been writing about problem passengers since the 1990s, and in almost all cases, alcohol is involved. Airlines have had plenty of warnings, from the drunken passengers who defecated on a meal cart to the epidemic of air rage during the pandemic. Take away the alcohol, and you remove some of the fuel that powers these outbursts of antisocial behavior. I've also seen the destruction alcohol can wreak on the ground. I've watched relationships get ripped apart, and I've lost friends to alcohol. And by lose, I mean they are dead. It affected me so profoundly that I stopped drinking a decade ago. The debate over alcohol consumption on flights is more nuanced than it might initially seem. While limiting or banning alcohol could improve passenger behavior and reduce incidents of air rage, it's not a decision airlines can make lightly. After all, alcohol sales contribute significantly to their bottom line, and many passengers look forward to that glass of wine or cocktail during their flight. But the consequences of excessive drinking on board, from unruly behavior to safety risks, can far outweigh the temporary pleasures of a drink. Abstaining from alcohol while in the air is a simple and responsible choice. After all, a few hours without a drink isn't too much to ask. And for airlines, perhaps it's time to prioritize passengers over profit and consider following the lead of carriers in the Middle East who have adopted a dry policy altogether. Maybe the real question isn't whether alcohol should be limited on flights, but whether the convenience of a drink is worth the potential risks that it brings to the flight experience.
Will tariffs cause prices in grocery stores to jump? Analyst: families face more cost uncertainty. How are tariffs and the threat of higher tariffs going to affect grocery prices in the United States? It depends, those in the food industry say. The United States produces and manufactures a lot of its food domestically, but also relies a lot on imported goods. The short answer is yes, prices are going to go up, said David Ortega, a food economist and professor at Michigan State University. They may not skyrocket for all imported products, but they will go up. Tariffs are a tax on imports, so by definition, they are inflationary. While higher tariffs could still be coming after a 90-day pause, the baseline 10% tariff on all goods, plus higher duties on Chinese products already in effect, are a big increase in food costs for Americans' budgets, said Thomas Grimillion, director of food policy at the Consumer Federation of America. The 10% default tariffs alone represent a truly historic federal tax increase, maybe the largest in my lifetime, with a highly regressive impact, Grimillion said. The tariff only applies to the value of the product at the border, Ortega said. Then there are additional costs to the product which are accrued domestically, like transporting the goods to the store, distribution, wholesale costs, and retail markups. Those things are not subject to the tariff, Ortega said. So that doesn't mean that the price of a particular product will go up by 10% or whatever the tariff is, Ortega said. Tariffs will cause price increases and uncertainty. Overall, 15% of the U.S. food supply is imported, including 32% of fresh vegetables, 55% of fresh fruit, and 94% of seafood, according to the Consumer Federation of America, citing the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Some products, like coffee and bananas, are almost exclusively grown abroad. Tariffs are causing uncertainty from families checking off their grocery lists to companies importing food, he said. For consumers, this can mean added difficulties in managing a food budget. For food companies, this means havoc on supply chains that could lead to more food waste and more food safety risk, Grimillion said. Seafood prices could see impact. One category that could be especially hit is seafood, Swanson said. It remains to be seen how that will be tariffed, especially with the trade war going on with China. A lot of seafood is caught here and then taken to China, where the labor is much more available and is a lower price to debone, to skin, to devein, and then to repackage, frozen, and brought back to the United States, he said. The question is, will that face tariffs? Will it be tariffed going in to China, tariffed coming out, and then will it become uneconomical for everybody? Swanson asked. Consumers have year-round demand for produce, fruits. Fresh produce will also likely cost more. Consumers will feel these price hikes at the grocery store, especially for products where we rely on imports to meet year-round consumer demand, Ortega told USA Today. Shoppers demand for fresh fruits 12 months a year is part of the reason why the United States imports many of them, Ortega said. We rely on international trade and imports for agricultural products in order to meet year-round consumer demand for a lot of these items, Ortega said. The United States can't grow some of the products domestically, such as bananas, or can only produce them seasonally, Ortega said. In many cases, it's cheaper to import food than to grow it domestically, largely due to labor cost differences, he said. Similarly, though a small amount of coffee is grown in Hawaii, we don't grow enough coffee domestically to be able to meet consumer demand, he said. So those things that are facing 10% tariffs, you will see the price go up, Ortega said. He added that low-income households are affected the most, since they spend a higher portion of their disposable income on food. Prices for some food products could go up even without tariffs. Some retailers may still increase the price of a product, even if the product itself wasn't subject to a tariff, said Chris Costolaghi, Vice President and Food Insights Lead for Nielsen IQ. Manufacturers have something called industry price gap management, which is the comparison of the price of their product versus their competitor, Costolaghi said. Even if you're a completely U.S.-based food product, if all your competitors' prices are going up because they're affected by a tariff, you may raise your price, he said. Additionally, a food product may have been made in the United States, so it doesn't have a tariff levied on it. But the packaging or other ingredients to make the food may be imported, Costolaghi told USA Today. That could lead to a price hike. Consumers are confused about tariffs. In a Nielsen IQ study in March, 81% of consumers surveyed said they were somewhat familiar with the effect of tariffs on grocery prices, and 73% believed the tariffs would impact the price of groceries. The survey was conducted when tariff discussion was only surrounding Canada and Mexico, and before the reciprocal tariffs were announced, then paused, and the hefty tariffs on China were implemented. But keeping track of tariffs is confusing, especially as the tariff policies have changed. There's a 25% tariff on goods from Mexico and Canada unless they are products covered under an agreement called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, and a 10% baseline tariff on all imported goods from other countries. There is a 145% tariff on goods imported from China. When Trump first announced the tariffs, he said all goods, including those coming from Mexico and China, and covered under the USMCA agreement, would be subject to the extra fees. But then the president backed off that decision, saying the USMCA-covered goods would not be tariffed. Additionally, there was a 90-day pause on any reciprocal tariffs beyond the 10%. Some agricultural and food products are covered under the USMCA, but it is difficult to distinguish which products are currently coming in with or without tariffs because there's an extra cost and hassle for importers to verify themselves under the USMCA. So some may just pay the tariff, Ortega said. And many are having to wait and see what other tariffs might happen. I think a lot of people just have no idea what is tariffed and what isn't tariffed, Kostolaki said. U.S. produces a lot of its own food, so prices could come down. The United States grows and produces a lot of food products and is a huge net surplus producer, which means we need to take that product out to the global markets. We just produce too much of it, said Michael Swanson, chief agricultural economist at Wells Fargo Agri-Food Institute. We export about 15% of our poultry overseas and about 20% of our pork overseas, Swanson said. If we lost some of those markets, that would have to stay in the domestic market and could actually depress prices, he said. So we might actually see pork and poultry prices come down as the market has to sell it in America first before they can reduce the supply on an ongoing basis, he said. To save, look for substitutions. Consumers can try to save money by sticking to foods that are grown, produced, or manufactured in the United States. And there's a lot of them, said Swanson. There will still be some things that they will have to pay more for if there is no substitution or if they're not willing to trade for a different product, he said. For instance, champagne from the Champagne region of France or Parmesan cheese that only comes from Parma, Italy. But there are growers of Parmesan cheese in Wisconsin, and that product is cheaper than the Parma, Italy version. Consumers may consider other substitutions like trying bourbon from Kentucky instead of scotch from Scotland, which could increase in price due to tariffs, Swanson said.
And now from the sports section, Triple Crown needs time changes. Every Kentucky Derby winning trainer has the same day after script when it comes to bringing their horse to the Preakness Stakes. And the line is usually some noncommittal variation of they'll tell us if they're physically ready to run back just 2 weeks later in the second jewel of the Triple Crown. Bill Mott was no different, May 4, the morning after Sovereignty's victory. But you could almost see the thought bubble forming in his words, telling the world not to be too surprised if he and the management team at Godolphin, which owns the horse, decide to take a pass on Baltimore. It's good to have that option, Mott told reporters waiting in his barn. I don't think we're dead set on it. I don't think that's the only thing that we're thinking about. Uh-oh. Is anyone in horse racing going to listen when the best trainers in the world and the people responsible for the health and well-being of the animal tells you over and over again that the Triple Crown is no longer viable in its current format? Sorry, traditionalists, but it's time for the Triple Crown to change. It doesn't have to be anything radical, but the modern racehorse is not bred or built to run three long races in 5 weeks, and there isn't a single high-level trainer in the country who would put their horse through that gauntlet unless there was a historic achievement on the line. Those who have resisted adding some time between the races have long argued that it cheapens the achievement if you remove part of the challenge. But what's actually been happening over the past several years is that so few horses run in all three races, it's already being cheapened. The ones that do, in general, don't come out better for it on the other side. Last year, Derby winner Mystic Dan ran in all three legs and then disappeared until December. He's 0-for-3 since then. Madge, the 2023 winner, ran in the Preakness and was never the same, retiring after two more races and several physical issues. I think over the years, people realize that spacing these horses out a little bit gives you the opportunity to make them last a little bit longer, Mott said. I think we're looking at a career, you know, and you want the career to last more than 5 weeks. There could not be a more damning indictment of how the Triple Crown is now perceived. This isn't the 1940s, when it was common for thoroughbreds to run every couple of weeks and sometimes actually run races in between the three-week gap separating the Preakness and the Belmont. This isn't the 1980s, when one of the premier Derby preps, the Bluegrass Stakes, was actually held 9 days before the Run for the Roses. And it's not even 2015, when the American Pharoah broke the 37-year drought and proved that the racing world, that it could still be done. And even as modern thoroughbreds become more injury-prone and less sturdy due to inbreeding and the commercial appeal of speed pedigrees over stamina, it can still be done. But at what cost? It's a long season, and he's had three hard races since February, and that takes a lot out of the horses. Michael Banahan, the director of American Bloodstock for Godolphin, told reporters, "It's a quick turnaround, and that's what makes the Triple Crown so special. He'll tell us yay or nay, and we'll do what he tells us to do. There's a lot of great opportunities and really good races to try to compete in and see if we can pad his resume even more." That last part seems significant. Because for the connections of a horse like Sovereignty, the Kentucky Derby was a goal, full stop. Everything they did in the winter and spring was designed to have him at his peak level of fitness for the first Saturday in May to run an incredibly grueling race. Often, the horses are so fit after the Derby that they can bounce right back 2 weeks later and deliver another monster performance. But it does grind them up. And the Preakness, for all its tradition and fanfare, is really just another big race. Yeah, running for the $2 million purse is nice, but what if the result is that they end up with a tired horse that isn't going to run in the $1 million Haskell Stakes, or the $1.25 million Travers at Saratoga, or the $7 million Breeders' Cup Classic at the end of the season? I think the Triple Crown is a huge challenge for any horse, Mott said. The great thing about it is that not many horses are able to do it, and certainly I believe that he's a big, strong horse, and if you're ever going to look at one, and if that's your goal and the goal of the owner, and it's still the best interest of the horse, well, then it's great. Everybody knows that American Pharoah won it and Justify won it in 2018, but we're going to look long term. If horse racing had its act together, this wouldn't be a debate. There would be 3 weeks or a month between the Derby and the Preakness, and another month to get ready for the Belmont. It would still be extremely hard to win, maybe harder because the Preakness and Belmont would have better fields. And it wouldn't be the end of the world. Though the spacing of the Triple Crown races has been consistent for decades, it has moved around a bit since the early days. There's nothing sacrosanct about squeezing it into 5 weeks, and the powers that be should have started a real conversation about changing things when they noticed in the 2010s how few horses anymore were running in all three races. After that thrilling Derby that could possibly be better for horse racing than having a Preakness, where you get Sovereignty, Journalism, and Baeza back for a rematch on a different track with different conditions. Instead, Pimlico will be lucky if one of the three shows up. And if that's the case, what's even the point of the Preakness anymore? As much as most fans want to see Sovereignty try for the Triple Crown, Mott holding him out of the race might just be the moment of clarity. Horse racing needs to finally admit that the current format is no longer in the best interest of the sport.
Hamilton's radio rants bring needed drama. Thank you, Lewis Hamilton. Your hilariously snarky outbursts over the Ferrari radio made the fourth annual Miami Grand Prix memorable for audiences around the world. More than we'll remember who won the race. No offense, Oscar Piastri. The McLaren driver has won 4 of the 6 races, with 16 more to go during the 2025 Formula One season. The thing about this Miami race, Lando Norris finished nearly 5 seconds behind his teammate Piastri in second place and 37 seconds ahead of Mercedes driver George Russell in third. This was a McLaren blowout. Any intrigue for a thrilling finish was gone, like Piastri when he took the lead from reigning F1 champion Max Verstappen during the 14th lap with 43 laps to go. That was until Hamilton jeered back and forth with race engineer Ricardo Adami when he had the pace to pass Ferrari teammate Charles Leclerc with about 10 laps remaining. As Hamilton stewed behind Leclerc without instruction, he said, "This is not good teamwork, that's all I can say." When Ferrari finally cleared Hamilton to pass after several laps, he snapped, "Have a tea break while you're at it, come on." Then Ferrari informed Hamilton that Williams's Carlos Sainz was 1.4 seconds behind him, get this, after he was asked to return his place back to Leclerc. "You want me to let him pass as well?" Hamilton shouted over the radio. Hamilton was jovial, lighthearted, and reflective after the race. He said he was happy with finishing in eighth place, if you can believe that from the seven-time F1 champion, while Leclerc finished seventh. "I want to win. I still got that fire in my belly. I could feel a little bit of it, like really coming out there. And I'm not going to apologize for being a fighter," Hamilton told USA Today Sports. "I'm not going to apologize for still wanting it. And I know everyone in the team does it too." Hamilton said he wasn't upset at Leclerc or Ferrari. His car simply isn't performing how he'd prefer overall, but he felt it really come alive after getting onto medium tires. He was able to, at least, see a McLaren car in the distance. He thought he had some chance to contend for at least sixth place. "It was all PG at least, right?" Hamilton said of his race comments. "I don't know what you're going to write, whether I was disrespectful or whatever." "Oh no, Lewis, quite the contrary. Thank you." The Miami GP would have ended without a climax if Hamilton's sarcasm and wit didn't carry the end of the race from an entertainment standpoint. The gap between Norris and Russell was so vast, Sky Sports analyst and former driver Martin Brundle said, "McLaren could have made another pit stop just for the fun of it and still won by 10 seconds. That's a measure of dominance." It's also a measure of how difficult it is for Formula One to hold on to the American attention span, beyond the fans who already clamor for the sport. This is far from a Miami problem. The Miami race has become one of the best on the F1 calendar 4 years into a 10-year deal. An extension was announced last week for another 10 years of the Miami Grand Prix through 2041. F1's presence in the United States runs through Miami, just like it does at the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas, another F1 newcomer in Las Vegas. F1's problem, however, is the moments of pure entertainment are few and far between. They're easily digested on social media clips instead of a two-hour race, unless the novice fan has elevated to appointment viewer. Significant intrigue comes at the start of every race around turn one, where the pack fights mightily to get out in front. Some drivers might overtake their struggling counterparts after the formation line is set. Others will swap places after they pit once or twice in the race. Then there are the safety cars after collisions. Some drama returns when the race is restarted. But if it comes near the end of the race, it sucks the drama out more because drivers in the lead just coast to a victory. Ask Norris, who won the Miami Sprint Race May 3rd and last year's Miami Grand Prix in this fashion. Hamilton won the Sprint Race in China and finished third in the Miami Sprint Race, but the pressure is mounting after his Grand Prix performances in his first season with Ferrari. He placed 10th in Australia, was disqualified in China, finished 7th in Japan, 5th in Bahrain, and 7th again in Saudi Arabia before what unfolded in Miami. Hamilton, Leclerc, and Ferrari appeared to all be at odds 6 races into being on the same side. The drama that unfolded was sports and reality TV at its finest, and Hamilton was absolutely hilarious. "I could have said way worse things on the radio. You hear some of the things other people said in the past," he said. "It was just some of your sarcasm. You got to understand that we're under a huge amount of pressure within the cars. You're never going to get the most peaceful messages in the heat of battle. It was fun," added Leclerc. "There's no bad feelings with Lewis. All I understand is he wants to try and optimize just as much as I want to try and optimize the car potential." After 6 races, Ferrari trails first-place McLaren in the constructors' standings by 152 points. They're also looking up at Mercedes and Red Bull. Hamilton is in 7th in the driver standings behind Piastri, 131, Norris, 115, Verstappen, 99, Russell, 93, Leclerc, 53, and his 18-year-old Mercedes replacement, Kimi Antonelli, 48. Hamilton's elusive 8th title might still be elusive this season, but he's striving for a chance to just compete at this point in his transition from Mercedes to Ferrari. "I truly believe that we fix some of the problems that we have with the car, we'll be back in the fight. It just can't come quick enough," Hamilton said. "I look forward to the time where maybe I can fight for a podium and be nice."
Washington will host 2027 NFL Draft. The 2027 NFL Draft will be held in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall, President Donald Trump announced on Monday from the Oval Office, predicting that it will be a draft like no other. Trump revealed the news alongside NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, Washington Commanders owner Josh Harris, and D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. "It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be something that nobody else will ever be able to duplicate," Trump said. The 2027 draft announcement comes 1 week after the Commanders revealed intentions to build a stadium on the old RFK Stadium site. Plans for the 65,000-seat venue still require the approval of the District of Columbia City Council. "It will not just be an event. It will be something that will show the world how far the nation's capital has come and where it's going," Goodell said. Since returning to the White House for a second term, Trump has made reducing crime and homelessness in Washington a focus of his administration to show the nation's capital. The National Mall, which can hold more than 1 million people, is flanked by the Washington Monument and U.S. Capitol, creating opportunities for dramatic visuals behind the draft stage. "Everyone in the world is going to be watching," Trump said. "We look forward to welcoming people from across the nation, from all over the world." After the 2025 NFL Draft was held in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the 2026 event is slated to be held in Pittsburgh. More than 600,000 fans attended the draft in Green Bay, which was held April 24 to 26. "Bringing this event to the nation's capital will help us fill hotel rooms, our restaurants, and Americans from all 50 states will come to their nation's capital, enjoy our beautiful city and museums," Bowser said. Hosting the NFL draft continues the Commanders' momentum after Harris bought the team in 2023 from longtime owner Daniel Snyder. Washington made the NFC Championship game last season, appears to have found its franchise quarterback in Jaden Daniels, and secured a long-coveted stadium deal to return the team from Maryland to the District of Columbia. Harris handed a personalized number 47 Commanders jersey to Trump, who commended the owner for completing a good draft last week and praised the team's great quarterback. "What a great day for Washington to host the NFL draft in 2027 on the Mall," Harris said. "I believe we'll get over 1 million people, and it's going to be an amazing day. And it'll showcase what Washington is all about. But it will also showcase what our country is all about."
Now moving to the life section, Avengers face off after Thunderbolts would be Pullman's full circle moment. Lewis Pullman needs to pay more attention to his emails. The star of Marvel's Thunderbolts admits it was his fault he missed the big live stream reveal of the Avengers Doomsday cast in March that found him joining Anthony Mackie and Chris Hemsworth in the A-list squad. "The signs were there," he says. Pullman remembered filming a short cameo for the Thunderbolts post-credits scene that sets up Doomsday, but wasn't totally clear about the whole thing. "After a day of shooting in Vancouver, I got back to my phone and I had all these texts. It was such a massive amount of possibilities that lie within that piece of information," Pullman, 32, says. Then again, he had a hard time believing he was joining the MCU in the first place. "It does feel like a little bit of this untouchable world. I just kept waiting for somebody to announce that they made some grand error, but I made it this far." Pullman's superhero, the Sentry, aka Robert Reynolds, is arguably the most powerful Avenger now. He does have a dark side to those abilities, though, which is explored alongside his character's new teammates, Yelena Belova, Florence Pugh, and Bucky Barnes, Sebastian Stan. The son of longtime Hollywood star Bill Pullman is no stranger to big-time franchises. He played Bob, the same name as his Marvel dude, opposite Tom Cruise in Top Gun: Maverick, part of a growing filmography that also includes Salem's Lot and the drama series Lessons in Chemistry, which garnered Pullman an Emmy nomination. Here's what fans need to know about Marvel's newest rookie. Pullman's Sentry proved to be a challenging hat trick. The movie reveals that Bob is a troubled meth addict who signed up to be experimented on by CIA director Valentina Allegra de Fontaine, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and become a super soldier. Thought to be dead, he teams up with the Thunderbolts, but is later turned into the Sentry, with a cape and supersuit to match his Superman-like powers. Another aspect of Bob is revealed as the Void, a dark and colorless figure that's a manifestation of his inner trauma. Everyone has these sort of shadow selves that sometimes, if you don't have the language to harness or control, or know when it's okay to exist with them, can bleed out in dangerous ways, Pullman says. So it's obviously quite messy. The void is in many ways a mirror that we often hide from, and then to be forced to look at it is really informative if you can sit through it. Playing the character meant having sort of like three jobs, he adds, and Pullman felt self-doubt going into Thunderbolts. Thankfully, he had Pew around as a Marvel mentor. She saw in me maybe a little bit of fear, probably. She didn't make a big deal out of it, and she just really subtly would give me a little piece of advice that was actually massive for me. Acting was one of many creative avenues for young Pullman. Pullman was raised in a very creative family. In addition to his Independence Day dad, mom, Tamara Hurwitz, is a modern dancer and choreographer. Sister, Maisa, is a singer and songwriter, and brother, Jack, designs masks and puppets. And his parents instilled in him the idea that you don't have to choose one thing, he says. Acting allows you to continue learning things that you would never really choose to do, Pullman says. I've become incredibly mediocre at so many different things from having a month or two of training, whether it be roping or rowing or paddleboarding or surfing. It pushes you to explore certain cavernous areas of yourself that normally you would neglect. Pullman does return to his other loves, too. After recently wrapping a movie, he came home for the first time in 2 months and immediately sat at his drum set for 3 hours. It's an amazing way to keep an even airflow throughout your creative avenues by continually shaking up the Etch-A-Sketch, he says. Pullman versus Robert Downey Jr., it might happen in New Avengers. Next up for Pullman is the historical drama musical Anne Lee, starring Amanda Seyfried, and he just finished production on Netflix's Remarkably Bright Creatures, an adaptation of the Shelby Van Pelt novel featuring Sally Field and a giant octopus. Pullman doesn't have a start date yet for Doomsday, which is filming in London, but any minute now, he says. The night he was announced for the new Avengers, I couldn't fall asleep just imagining all the different avenues and possibilities that Bob could kind of go down, Pullman said. The cast is an embarrassment of riches, and he's hoping to do at least one scene with Robert Downey Jr. as Dr. Doom. Iron Man is really how I fell in love with Marvel. So that would be a wild full circle moment for me.
Dead Outlaw, a brilliant, strange but true musical. Who needs a defibrillator when you have Dead Outlaw? David Yazbek's latest curio, which opened April 27 at the Long Acre Theater, is a waggish, walloping, what-in-tarnation musical. The sort of coup that is so sublimely strange and strangely profound, it will revive your faith in Broadway itself. That's a whole lot of words for a show where the lead character spends half of the 100-minute runtime with his mouth pursed shut in a casket. But that's also part of its genius. Dead Outlaw is based on the unbelievable true story of Elmer McCurdy, a haplessly inept train robber who was born in 1880, died in 1911, and was buried in 1977. After he was gunned down by police, McCurdy's body laid unclaimed in an Oklahoma funeral home for months. Embalmed with liberal amounts of arsenic, he was eventually propped up and put on display in a look so the looky-loos paying 2 bits to gawk at the so-called bandit who wouldn't give up. But McCurdy's story didn't end there. For decades, his mummified corpse was passed around and sold into traveling carnivals, wax museums, and exploitation movies, ultimately landing at the amusement park in Long Beach, California, where McCurdy's body was painted flaming red and was strung up in a haunted house. The macabre details of how his remains were discovered and identified were all revealed at the top of the show, which traces his wild, woebegone journey from Jesse James wannabe to neglected carry-on. Dead Outlaw is ingeniously directed by David Cromer, whose production is arrestingly lit by Heather Gilbert, with kooky, homespun scenic design from Arnulfo Maldonado. The narrative unspools like a spellbinding campfire tale at a six-piece band led by the gruff yet inviting Jeb Brown, unleash a maelstrom of mandolin and banjo-laden earworms from McCurdy's snarling barnstormer, Killed a Man in Maine, to the sultry stick-em-up Indian Train. With electrifying score written by Yazbek and Eric Della Pena, it's pure, undistilled Americana, but with the scorching Rock Edge of Passing Strange, and the mordant satiric delights of Little Shop of Horrors. In Up to the Stars, a coroner, played by Tom Sesma, croons Dean Martin style atop his autopsy table, musing how even the most sensational deaths all come down to forensic pathology in the end. And in the sweet and sour Millicent song, A Teenage Misfit, played by the phenomenal Julia Cattell, divulges her youthful fears and yearnings to the lifeless McCurdy, who's been stashed in her living room by her filmmaker dad. As the girl prepares to leave home, she confesses her unwanted envy for the felonious Crowbait. You get to stay the same, and I wish that I could too. Growing up ain't as easy as it seems. Duran delivers the most indelible performance of the season as McCurdy, motionless, flat-eyed, and unblinking as he stands upright in a wooden coffin for much of the show, reduced to a rifle-toting ragdoll. It's a mind-blowing physical feat, to be clear, but he has also imbued the Tech T character with a potent, devastatingly undercurrent. As imagined by playwright Itamar Moses in his incisive yet humane book, McCurdy was someone who longed to make some sort of mark on the world, but he had neither the good fortune nor the skills to achieve much of anything. The harsh reality is, most of us aren't destined to be revered or remembered, and it's impossible not to take pity on our perished desperado as he's continually chewed up and discarded as a trifling sideshow oddity. When the clock finally runs out, all we really hope for and deserve is some peace. That futility and tragedy is poignantly rendered in Duran's stiff, cold hands. In the staggering Dead Outlaw, death is both commodified and desensitized, a cruel fact of life that we are pummeled with repeatedly throughout the musical. Your friends are dead, your dog is dead, and so are you, Brown growls in a cheeky, name-dropping finale. But in facing our bleak, mortal coil with a laugh and a song, McCurdy, hair-raising, pulse-racing, resuscitation, helps us all feel a little more alive.
And a short from the Moneyline section, what happens if I show up to fly without a real ID? The Real ID deadline is May 7th, and it's going to be harder to travel if you don't have the right documents at the airport. Real ID is a new standard for state-issued identification documents that includes more stringent requirements for verifying a person's identity and right to residency. Federal identification documents, like passports, are also compliant. However, even for a domestic flight, if you show up at the airport without a Real ID driver's license, a passport, or another acceptable document to present at the Transportation Security Administration checkpoint, you could face delays or even be prohibited from traveling. Ford has their April sales surged 16% ahead of tariffs. Ford Motor Company reported a record sales month for April, with U.S. sales climbing 16% as the company offered employee pricing across its lineup to all customers as uncertainty loomed about President Donald Trump's tariff plans and the prospect that they would soon increase vehicle prices. Ford reported on May 1st that it sold 208,675 new vehicles in April, compared with 179,588 sold in April 2024. Sales of electrified vehicles, which includes hybrids, rose 8.4% to 28,190. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Marjorie Huntington
and Allie Irving have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. Again, that's 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 a.m. for readings from the News and Observer. Up next is our featured program, Independent Living.